At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Hey up, everybody. My name's Joshua Morrison, Director Johnny Mozzer's Lessons and Conference today. I want to talk to you a little bit about advertising and how advertising can have quite a profound impact on your mind. Now, we all kind of know that, you know, you see a Coca-Cola advert, they're not trying to make you think, "Oh, Coca-Cola, I'll buy one of those." They're not trying to do that. What they're trying to do is they're trying to subconsciously implant Coca-Cola into your mind so that the next time you might see Coca-Cola in a shop, you might pick it over the Pepsi because you've remembered that Coca-Cola advert, but you don't even necessarily really remember the advert, right? You don't remember the specific, I don't know, Merry Santa, whatever Coca-Cola's got going on for them at the moment. You remember just Coca-Cola, and you remember that you have seen Coca-Cola before, and that's why you go and buy it. That's why, you know, brands that you already know will go out to advertise things, because you have this familiarity with them that is being built, this rapport that's being built, but it's a one-sided rapport that they're building with you, essentially, where they're trying to make you feel comfortable and accepted within that brand's presence. And that's kind of the idea of advertising. Now, it's different for someone that's maybe like your size. If you're like a creator or whatever and you're trying to get out there and try and get your name out there, you need to approach things in a different way. It's not good enough to just get your name out there, because random YouTuber number 658-B doesn't mean anything to, you know, any of the people that are walking past or anyone that's like in the comment section of this. It doesn't mean anything to them yet because you haven't built that rapport. Now, how do you build that rapport? Well, first off, think about it like this. Say you meet someone who's really nice, right? And like, I don't know, you've got a crush on them and you kind of want to spend a lot of time with them. How would you get them to sort of be close with you and become like your partner? What's the steps that you would take towards that? Well, first off, you need to talk to them, right? You need to go up to them and have some kind of conversation so that you have some kind of impression that they can have of you for when they go off and sort of think, "Oh, that guy was kind of nice." It's the same way with advertising. You need to have something that will make some kind of impact, because you know what? The advert that you probably saw before this, it's probably not for anything of any worth. Probably wasn't anything very interesting. I probably shouldn't say that. You know, the advert you just watched is worthless. Don't bother with it, you know? But at the end of the day, you don't really remember. You probably just watched it, and then like the second the skip ad button came up, you skipped it, right? And I don't blame you, because I do the exact same thing. We all do the exact same thing, because we don't want to see advertising. We are being put in a situation where we don't want to be in, because we don't want to be fucking force-fed some garbage about a product. We don't care about the product, right? So how do you make someone care about the product? That's a good question, and it's a tough question, because you know, every different brand has a different way of doing it. You know, an insurance company is going to advertise to you different than soft drink, and that's going to advertise to you different than like the new movie that comes out. All of these things will advertise to you in different ways. So say a movie, for instance, what might you recognize about a movie? The actors, right? A movie stars Brad Pitt or Tom Cruise or whatever. So now you have a familiarity because you've seen Tom Cruise and Brad Pitt and things before. You've heard other people talk about them. They are known as like the famous actors in the cultural zeitgeist. They are like the top of the food chain, right? And you know, you've seen them in something and you kind of think, yeah, Brad Pitt's quite good. Tom Cruise is quite good in certain roles. I liked him in, I liked Tom Cruise in War of the Worlds. So say another Alien movie comes out and it's got Tom Cruise in it. I might think, well, he was good in War of the Worlds, so I might watch this. Or what they might do is they might do directed by whoever, right? Say it's directed by Steven Spielberg. Right, well, I've seen plenty of Steven Spielberg movies and I think that he's a good director. So I'm more likely to watch it because I now have familiarity with this thing because I have seen things that are similar to it in the past. Now, if you're making movies or you're making music, you don't quite have that luxury. So you need to find another approach. So horror movies are a very good example, because horror movies are a very big cult sort of thing, and people will watch horror movies that are made by nobodies, that are made for very little money. And that's why you get so many indie filmmakers that go out and make horror movies, because they see them as a good marketing sort of thing, because they have a built-in audience, right? So because they have a built-in audience, that means that you're able to get something out of it, because, you know, there's people that will come and watch it. There's horror fans out there. There's people that go nuts for horror movies, right? So why wouldn't you make a horror movie over, say, I don't know, a drama? Because what's a drama? Drama is the most vague term out there. It means nothing, because all it means is it's not a comedy, I guess. That could mean anything. Like, Schindler's List is a drama. Trainspotting is a drama. They're two totally different films, but they're both dramas, right? So you need to make something, if you're trying to advertise to someone, that someone might actually want. Now, how do you do that? Again, it's through the familiarity, because, you know, say with Prime, I just saw a Prime advert go past on the bus, right? I know Prime because I've used Amazon before. I've thought that Amazon delivered quite well, quite fast, and they have quite a big range on their thing. I'm not advertising Amazon right now, by the way, just to make it clear. I'm just using them as an example, right, of a product, feature, service that you are familiar with, right? And because you are familiar with it, that means that you're going to be more likely to accept it, because it's built a trust with you compared to, say, some random site that no one's ever heard of. This is why Temu, for instance, put so much money into advertising constantly, and they do these quite big, bombastic, very loud adverts, because they want to build a brand recognition. They want to be known as the company that sells stuff for 5p. They want to be known as the company that has things really, really cheap, right? And now they have built that rapport. I see people in my real life that have used Temu, and I've noticed that everyone that I've known that has used Temu has had a negative experience from it. So again, not advertising. I'm not advertising Temu, or however the hell you pronounce it, right? I'm not advertising any of these products that I talk about. However, it feels like it's hard to talk about advertising without inherently advertising, just because I have to use examples. Because I need to name a product that you already know, a service that you already know, and you need to have some kind of understanding for it. And because I have told you about that product, it's reminded you. This is why companies love word of mouth so much. This is why the Blair Witch Project started off by spreading the rumor from all across America about the Blair Witch, so that when they made the film, people knew what the Blair Witch was. And that's part of why the Blair Witch was such a successful film, because it built a familiarity, because they thought outside the box in how to make a familiarity, almost a parasocial relationship, the same way that, you know, an audience has with the creator. It's the same way that, you know, a target demographic or a market base would have towards a product or a service. You know, like, say, I don't know, Thai massages, for instance, right? Someone I know recently had a Thai massage, and they said it was brilliant, right? That means I am more likely to get a Thai massage, right? Or I might just say, if someone else is thinking about getting a Thai massage, I might say, oh, someone I know just had a Thai massage, and they said it was great, right? And that might be the thing that pushes that person that was going to get a Thai massage over the edge to actually go and do it. Because we all like to talk. We all like to talk about how we're going to get this, or we're going to do that. But it's only through the actual push that we actually do these things, right? So how can you, as someone who is trying to make a product or make a service or make something that can be advertised to someone, how can you make it actually so that person will actually go for it? So I'll give you an example of some times when advertising has worked on me, because advertising doesn't work on me vastly. Like, I did business studies at GCSE. I'm not saying that as a brag, but I'm just saying it, like, you know, I understand vague amounts of how the marketing advertising thing sort of works. And you know that it's not a completely innocent thing, obviously. And that even talking about these products, I was very tempted to make this video without referring to any products, but I thought it was just kind of impossible. And I also kind of wanted to make the video as a point that no matter what you discuss, if you name the thing, you will advertise it. There have been times when an advert has really annoyed me, right? An advert has just pissed me off, right? And I've wanted to talk about that. I remember, like, when I used to use Facebook, like, 8 years ago, if an advert really annoyed me, I would screenshot, like, a bit of the advert, and I would post it to Facebook, and I would talk about how fucking much the advert annoyed me, right? I'm doing exactly what they want, They want me to be annoyed at it, because me being annoyed at it means I'm going to talk to other people about how annoying the advert was, but they haven't seen the advert, so they don't know the annoying bit. So the fact that it was annoying is just going to melt away out of their brain, and what's going to be replaced is the product, the thing, right? I remember the Cadbury's Gorilla drumming thing, right? I fucking hated that advert. It really annoyed me, right? And you know what? I remember, because I was quite young when it came out, and I remember just telling everyone how much this advert hated me. I was doing exactly what Cadbury's wanted me to do, okay? I was talking about them. That's it. That's all that this is. This is why people will go out and do rage bait. This is why you have, like, you know, YouTube pranksters or whatever the new thing is. You know, like, people that just really, like, miserable, nasty, annoying people. The reason that they are like that is because it gains attraction. Because what happens is one person sees it and they think, God, this is fucking annoying. How could anyone like this? That's person A. Person A speaks to person B and goes, God, have you seen this thing? It's so fucking annoying. Person B goes, oh, I've not seen it, no. Right? Person B then goes off and has a nice day, right? And they forget about this conversation. Right? And then, say they get back a couple days later, right? And they're sat down in front of their phone, and they're just scrolling through, and they see that same YouTube prankster, whatever the thing that person A saw was, right? And they go, oh, I recognize that. Where do I recognize that from? And they won't remember the specific interaction with person A, but they'll sit there and go, oh, what was that? What was that? I can't remember. And then they might click it just to even remind themselves of what it was. And now that they've done that, the advertising has worked. The marketing word of mouth has occurred. And the product itself is a load of shit, right? Because what happens is, we all like to get annoyed about stuff, and we all like to talk about stuff that's irritating, because it can be fun, because we can be a bit animated about it, and there's so many fun, negative words out there to describe things, right? This is why in 2016, like the YouTube H3 iDubbbz and all that sort of stuff, that's why they were so negative and they were reacting to negative stuff, because they were in a way giving those people exactly what they wanted, because they were giving them attention, they were giving them the potential for a new audience, right? I remember Colossal is Crazy, he was a YouTuber, like, he had a very posh voice, and he did a video on this guy called FoozyTube, right? And FoozyTube is this right, like, knobhead, right? And he did this 45-minute, like, quite funny documentary, like, expose thing on him, right? Just talking about how shitty he was in general, right? And I remember I went to see a friend, and my friend really liked FoozyTube, and so what I did was, like, A bit nasty in retrospect, is I just put the fucking 45-minute documentary on. Oh, you like this thing? Well, here's a video about how much it's shit, you know? I have then given both Colossal is Crazy and FoozyTube what they want, because he probably wasn't that bothered about FoozyTube in that exact moment. Yeah, he really liked him, but he might not have, you know, gone out of his way to watch him. Now that it's been drilled into his mind about FoozyTube, he's going to go and see more FoozyTube stuff. And because FoozyTube has, like, appeared in his algorithm, because I've searched for it on his computer, it's now going to appear more, because the YouTube algorithm will think, oh, he likes FoozyTube, let's give him some more FoozyTube stuff. Let's give him some more of this. Let's give him some more of that sort of thing that he doesn't like. That's why your algorithm is so full of shit. That's why I hate the YouTube short sort of thing, because it gets me down a really dark rabbit hole of just negative content, because I end up sticking around for longer on the stuff that just pisses me off. Like, I end up watching the Andrew Tate thing a lot longer and something's a lot nicer, because I'm sitting there going, God, what a disgusting fucking person that is. And I'm giving him more of my time. And because I'm giving him more of my time, the YouTube algorithm thinks, oh, there's something that I'm going to give him more of. That's how stuff like Andrew Tate and, like, all this, like all these political figures that everyone thinks, how can anyone like him? That's how they're able to spread, because they are able to harness the power of the negative impression and the power of word of mouth. Because these two things that come together mean that word of mouth means that you say it to someone else, and that person doesn't have the negative impact that you've had from previously seeing it. So they go and see it. They might get the same negative impression. They go out and speak to it. Say person B saw that thing that was on the YouTube that person A told them about, and they also really hate it. What they do is then they go and tell person C about how shit this thing is, and then person C does the exact same thing, and then the same thing happens again and again and again and again until you get to person Z. Right? And then in all of those people, one of them didn't think it was a load of shit. One of them thought it was really nice, right? Look at JLS. Does anyone like JLS? Someone must, because they toured all over the place. They were huge, right? Look at One Direction. Do people like really like that? Yes, they did. But just because we all talk about this stuff about how shit it...
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
And how could anyone like it? There are people out there that do like it. And the fact that we talk about how shit this thing is means that we are exposing that thing that is shit to a potential audience of people who will disagree with us, right? That's the power of advertising. Advertising is an extremely important tool in your repertoire. And I don't mean this to just say, go and be a knobhead and you'll get instant success, because it's a tried and tested formula and you need to be really good at it in order to make it work. It's not like a guaranteed thing, right? And it's the same way, like if Coca-Cola tried that to just be as big of an arsehole as possible, it wouldn't quite work for them, right? I think the knobhead approach works for like up and comers, but if you're already established, all you need to do is just make people remember your name. And if you're new, you need to make sure that people know your name and know who you are and know what you are, most importantly, right? So yeah, I think that's gonna be the video. I hope you managed to get something out of this. I know it was a little bit all over the place, but I hope you did manage to get something out of it all the same. Thank you so much for watching it. Here's an advert. I don't know if you can see it. There's the advert, there. Otez. I've never heard of Otez in my bloody life. Don't know what it is. I don't plan on using it anytime soon. But take care, everybody. Bye-bye. And don't engage with that advert. Engage with another advert. And if you're trying to become some kind of advertiser, if you have a product to advertise, just remember that it's important to get your name out there as much as humanly possible, because the more negative impressions you make, the more, because like it's a percentage. Say you make 90% negative impressions and you make 1 million impressions. That's 10,000 impressions that were positive from people who would like you. Okay? So thank you very much for watching this. Take care. Love you all. And yeah, see you all very soon. Hope you had a good Christmas as well. Hey up, everybody. My name's Joshua Morrison, director of Johnny Mozza's Lessons in Confidence. And today I'm here to talk to you a little bit about architecture and how architecture can vary depending on the culture and the time period. So obviously you go back in the day, you've got a lot of really big ornate buildings. You've got churches, you've got temples and all that sort of stuff, right? Really impressive, quite beautiful pieces of architecture. However, what you don't realize is that there was an awful lot of garbage that was out around that same time as well. Really terrible pieces of architecture that were just strut up because it's a necessity. You need a roof over your house, okay? You need a roof over the shop. It doesn't need to look great. Thatch roofing was not a, you know, trendy sort of thing. It wasn't sort of like, oh, I want to get a thatch roof so that I can be the best person with a thatch roof so that I can show my status. It wasn't. It was just like, there's thatch all over the bloody shop. Like, look at all this stuff here. Obviously, it's not thatch, but you could turn it into, actually, I don't think the camera can see it, but you could use the things that are around you to actually make buildings. Now we have, diggers and cranes and lots of concrete and steel and things like that. So we're able to make, I'm gonna move out of the way so that you can see, that right there is Twickenham or Kingston, something like that. It's one of those places. So first off, I want you to pay close attention to that white red sort of building there, right? Looks fucking awful, okay? That is not a nice building. However, that building is not designed to look nice. It's designed to do what it needs to do, okay? It looks like it's some kind of warehouse or on a shopping center or a big car park or something like that. It's designed to make sure that people can get to the place they need and do the thing they need to do. It's not there to look pretty. And I feel like with regard to some of the discourse around architecture at the moment, particularly like, you know, the idea that buildings should look beautiful, which I do agree with. I'd rather we didn't have it look like that. I'd rather stick some sort of terracotta on it, okay? That would look really good. However, I feel like the issue comes around when you get to the cost of it. Because obviously, if you wanted to chuck terracotta on that, that is gonna cost a lot. Now, obviously you could do some kind of tax incentives, but I'm guessing since basically no country in the world does that, that there's like some good reason that they don't do that, I presume, okay? So what I think you should try and take away from this video is you're going around your little local area, right? And you're seeing all these new builds cropping up all over the place, and you're like, Jesus Christ, another one? It looks shit. And then you see another one down there, and they all look exactly the same because they're based off the same templates. The blueprints are basically exactly the same, and you'll see them just copy-pasted like you're in SimCity or something. And what I find a little bit frustrating is you go around and you do feel like a lack of culture because all of these buildings kind of look the same. Like when I went to Milan, I was in the center of Milan, and I was kind of walking around going, oh, wow, Central Station, it's beautiful, and it really is beautiful. It's a bloody amazing station. It's huge. It'd probably take up this entire shot, that whole thing there. It's massive, it is. Really ornate, beautiful Italian architecture, right? But I think when you get out into the suburbs and the outskirts of Milan, like when I got off on the plane and we're on the little coach thing that takes you into town, right? We're going down the motorway and there's these giant warehouses cropping up all over the place. They look a mess, okay? They look terrible. And I think that is kind of true Italian architecture in a way, because I think the issue comes around when every country has these same kind of things. Every country has the same sort of thing going on where it's just a, you know, you've got nice stuff in the middle for all the tourists to look at, and then you go out a little bit and it's kind of not that good. And then you go a little bit further out, and then it kind of starts to get a bit better once you start getting out to the countryside, because, you know, it's a really small little town. You're sitting there your whole life, so you've got to have something nice to look at. So that makes perfect sense. However, in cities like this, you kind of need, and this is in a city, believe it or not, we need this kind of thing, unfortunately, because we have economies to run, we have stuff to do, shit needs to get done. So that works, okay? You go in your house looks a wreck from the outside, but you go in and you decorate and make it your own, all right? So I feel like, I mean, I don't get me wrong, I like seeing a little, you know, old church or something like really nice looking get turned into a Tesco Express, but then you kind of think, oh, hang on, that's a really nice church. Why is it being a Tesco Express? Why don't we use it for something else? I don't know. I don't have the answer to that. I suppose capitalism's the answer to that, really. But it's just ridiculous what's going on with all the buildings and stuff. We got so many, like, if you look at that one there, I don't know if you can see it in the frame, but it's like this giant tower block, right? In the 60s and the 50s and the post-war period in Britain, we started chucking up loads of them because we needed as many houses as possible. And it did work. It really helped because suddenly houses were all over the shop. The problem was, is that they were a wreck. They were shit. And if you lived in them, your life was kind of miserable. And so people stopped wanting to live in them. And so, I don't know, the market forces, I suppose, made, you see all them little bits of brown and like white in like the more foreground of the background? That's just standard suburban housing, really. That's just your single family homes. And that's, I don't know, I feel like people generally want that. They don't really want to live on like floor 30 of a building. Have you ever been to a mate's house and they live on like the top of a tower block and you go on their balcony and you just look out and sure, the view's spectacular, but then you look down and it's like, fuck that. No, not having that. No, please, no, can we stop doing that? Because if I had to live like that the whole time, I would be like this. I'd be like a little mouse everywhere. I'd crawl from spot to spot. One of my friends, I go to their house, they live on like the 9th floor and they have a balcony, right? That's kind of like, it comes up to about here on me, right? Comes up to about my waist. I'm quite a tall person, so I have to really duck down if I'm on that balcony. And I literally just go on my hands and knees and just scoot around because it's not worth falling off that, frankly. I don't want that. And I also don't want to fall on some poor sod and take them with me. So, yeah. Sorry this is a bit of a rambly sort of video. Didn't really have an idea for this one, but I just wanted to talk about architecture because there's loads of it there. And you've got little various styles. And like, there's so many little buildings around here. You got the suburban cottages from like probably Victorian, Edwardian sort of period, and then you got ones that are further back that are obviously built in the 60s and the 70s, and then you got other stuff that's even further back. That's probably like, I don't know, 1977, something like that. I don't know. I've just made that year up, and I've made a lot of this stuff up. So if you actually have some knowledge on architecture, the history of architecture, and the future of architecture, please leave it in the comments below. We can all educate each other and just see what the conversation takes us and see if we can come to any good conclusions about the nature of urban civilization, because it is quite interesting, because it's what we are surrounded by. Most likely there's at least a 50% chance, probably higher considering my audience, that you live in a city, right? And you're walking around and you're seeing all these fucking skyscrapers and you're seeing all these big things all over the shop, and it might feel a little bit intimidating, but it's just what you need. It's just, it gets the job done, you know? If it was something different, if a different thing got it done, we'd all be living in underground, I suppose. I don't know. So yeah, that's the video. Thank you very much for watching this. Yeah, put some comments in below about architecture. Do you live in a nice building? Obviously, don't tell us where you live, but if you live in a nice building, tell us about it, because I'd like to know. And I'll maybe do a proper video on this topic at some point when I've done some actual research on it and not just spouting shit, really. So yeah, thank you very much. I'm gonna go down there. And the videos are up there, by the way. That one's on like something, and that one's on music. I realize my arms are probably aren't. Yeah, I'm completely out. All right. Hey up, everybody. My name's Joshua Morrison, director of Johnny Mozzles Lessons in Confidence. And today I want to talk to you a little bit about impulse buying. Now, I am a bit of a sucker for a good deal. If I see like a buy one, get one free thing, I'll end up getting it. And if it's like buy one, get one 50% extra, I'll sort of think, oh, I could get two of them. But I don't need two, I only really need one. And you know, if I'm just passing a supermarket, I think, well, it's gonna be cheaper than it is down the bottom of my road. So I might as well just go to the supermarket now and get whatever I need to get. I never actually need to get anything. I just wander up and down the aisles, just sort of like, ooh, the salmon's on the yellow label. Yeah, but yeah, the salmon's gonna sort of, because if it's fish already, you're a little bit sort of dodgy, so you know, it could go off, and if it's already on the yellow label, then maybe. But then, yeah, if I have it tonight, or I have it tomorrow morning, that's perfect, so I get that, bam. I need to get some Greek yogurt. Oh, well, this one's on the yellow label. But that means if I get the one on the yellow label, it means I might get it 50% cheaper, but I might only eat 25% of it before it actually goes out of date, because I know myself, I'm not gonna eat it that quickly. It's the same way, whenever I go to Lidl, right, I wanna get leeks. I never need two leeks, right? I swear, every supermarket I go to sells leeks in packs of two. I don't really understand why I would need two leeks, okay? Because it's something that doesn't last that long, and when you use it, you don't need that much at a time. So I'm always running out of this sort of stuff, and then, you know, you buy stuff, and then it ends up going off because you've got too much stuff to actually get through, and you can end up impulse buying just stuff that looks nice. And like today, for instance, on the way here, I went to Morrison's, and actually carrying the camera around doing these videos actually really beneficial for preventing impulse buying, because all I could really get is stuff that would fit in my pocket. So I got some shortbread fingers, right? 85 pence. Those were, I think, 70 pence. And then I got some digestives, milk chocolate top. They were 85 pence, so that's about £1.50 right there on something that doesn't matter, something that I don't need. I'm only having these so that whenever I have my tea or my coffee, and I have a lot of coffee, I can just dip and I can dip, but I know what's going to happen. They're going to sit at my desk, they're going to sit there for 2 weeks, I'm not going to have them, and I'm going to sit there and go, ooh, aren't I doing well for myself? I haven't had those biscuits in 2 weeks, I'm going to have one. And then they're all going to be gone within the space of 2 days. And then repeat the cycle, repeat the process. Why not just try and slam the brakes on this and just get it stopped? Because whenever I have done, you know, less impulse sort of shopping, and I put down exactly what I need, this is why I like cash. If I take cash when I go shopping, right, say I take a £20 note, I can get £20 worth of stuff. I know what I'm gonna get, and if it goes over, tough, right? So sometimes whenever I'm trying to save money, I don't even take my card with me. So I don't take this, I just stuff £20 in here, go to the shop, and I manage to get whatever I need to get. And that works a lot better for me, and I need to start getting back into that rhythm, because you can save so much money and you can eat better by just going and just ensuring that you're basically rationing, like self-imposed rationing. And you can get so much more in terms of like good deals and stuff like that. If you go to the shop sort of closer to the closing time, you're more likely to find stuff on the yellow labels. There's all these sort of tricks of the trade where you can get stuff. I remember there used to be this really cool trick with this site called Get Here. And basically it was, you spend £10 and then you get £10 off. So if you spend like £10.01, you're basically paying 1p for £10 worth of shopping. And you'd do that and you would get all your friends to use an account, and each of you would get the shopping for like, because we were in uni dorms and stuff. So we'd get 10 people together, they'd all get an account. So that's £100 worth of shopping that we got for like £1 something. And it's good quality stuff as well. Like they didn't muck around. And this is probably why you don't see many Getir vans around anymore, Getir bikes or whatever.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
So you don't see that kind of thing anymore, but there's all little tricks of the trade to save and little bits of money. I do this thing every now and then called a Zip It. It's this app where if you're walking down the road and you see like someone's left a pile of books out, you just take your phone out, right? You take your phone out and you just scan them. And sometimes it comes up with nothing, but sometimes it comes up with 10p or 50p or a pound or whatever. And I'm not going to act like I've made mad money on it. In about 2 years, I've made something like £150 off it. That's £150 that, you know, has gone to me for something that basically took no effort. All I did was I collected the books, they stayed on a shelf, and then I would go and find some box. At some point, there's going to be a box that I noticed lying around somewhere. Bit of sellotape around the end of it. Slap the label on it. I make sure that they send me a label rather than have to get me print out the label. That means I've got to go to the library and I've got to pay 20 pence just to print out a label for it. Fuck all that, when I can just get them to send me the thing. And then I take it down to the shop, the DPD bloody service takes it off, and then a couple of weeks later it's like £15 into my account. And I just do that every now and then, and that's a nice little fun way of making, because I don't really have to do anything. And also, if you're walking along with someone, it's a nice little sort of social thing of like, oh, I wonder what books they've got, oh, I wonder what they're doing. And you can tell them about this little idea, and then they start doing it in their own area, and some areas are obviously better than others. Yeah, it's quite fun. You can find all sorts of crazy stuff. I mean, I found complete DVD box set at The Office. That was pretty good. And I found series 1 through 5 of Peep Show. So I thought that was pretty decent. They were worth about £3. I didn't sell them. I wanted them for myself. Because you never know, if all the internet goes out, I want something on DVD. So yeah, I feel like with regards to shopping and saving money and impulse buying and stuff, it's very easy to fall to the traps of consumerism. I mean, there's a reason that they put these deals out there, because they're trying to ensnare you and make you think that you're being savvy and smart, when really you're being suckered into the thing that they want you to do, which is to spend more of your money than you were going to before. Say if you bought four, you notice now, it's like buy 6, get 1 for free. I remember I was buying some tin pineapple, right? And it was like buy 6, get them for the price of 3. I don't need 3 tins of pineapple, let alone 6. I needed 1, right? But I ended up buying 6, and that meant I spent 3 times more money than I would have spent otherwise. Because in my head, they've managed to make me think that I'm saving money when I'm not. I'm spending more money. So they do this. They do this to try and get you to feel like you're savvy, to try and make you feel like you're doing something that, you know, you're cheating the system almost a little bit. When there's better ways of cheating the system. There's better ways of like getting your own out of, you know, the profits of these giant mega corporations that don't give a shit about you. There's ways that you can scrape your little bit off the top. And if you go out there and figure out your own little way around, you'll find something. So I'd love if any of you have come up with any weird little tricks to saving money while you're shopping, or saving money like by finding some like weird online service that managed to make you save money or whatever. Please don't put any fucking scams in there, but because I'll moderate this so that there's no scams going on. But yeah, if you found any sort of weird little tricks like my little Get Here trick, or if there's a new version of that, let me know. Or, you know, if you found anything, because also different countries will have different things. This is all applying to Britain. So if you're in America, you've probably got your own version of this. You go to Walmart and there's some like probably on a customer loyalty scheme that you can probably make some weird advantage out of. I know my mate, he's like very loyal to Tesco because he gets like money on his car and he gets money on his everything. And so he manages to work and save like £100 a year out of that, which like the, so that basically pays for his Christmas shop essentially. So there's all those kind of little things that you can do to sort of save yourself a little bit of money here and there. I've had to start getting all these bloody loyalty cards. Honestly, it's a joke. I mean, what have I got in here? What have I got? There's, at the moment, there's a day pass to Reading. There's a Nectar card. And I think I've got a Tesco club card in here somewhere as well. But yeah, I've got these two. Tesco card and a club card. I don't want these, man, because they're taking all my data. They're, you know, they're taking my shopping habits and they're using that to try and sell me more stuff, to try and market stuff to me. And then they're using this to inform their own, you know, product surveys and stuff like this, and what products they're going to put out where and all this kind of crap. So, you know, I am selling my data for the sake of saving a few quid, but I don't know. I mean, I am saving a few quid out of it. And if I need a few quid, then I should, what? I mean, how important is my privacy, I suppose? That's a question that's way beyond the scope of this video. I think for now, we're just going to talk about the practicalities of going out there and doing little things and trying to stop yourself from doing this and buying random shit you don't need, and especially junk food like this. I mean, like, this isn't going to do me any good. I mean, sure, I could have gone for the fig rolls, but even the fig rolls aren't that healthy. I don't know. It's just a bit of a pain in the ass, really, trying to figure all this sort of stuff out. But yeah, I don't know. I do like shopping. I quite enjoy it. It's quite nice going around the little, like, Lidl or whatever and just sort of trying to find all the best little deals and seeing if you can beat how much you spent before in terms of, like, trying to undercut it and getting the same amount of stuff. But now even Lidl's got their bloody Lidl Plus card that I've got to sign up for so that I can get the cherry, sour cherry conserve for 30 pence cheaper, and I can get their packets of own brand Doritos for 15 pence cheaper. It's like, fuck off. Well, I'm just not going to buy that stuff anymore then. That's the point I'm at now, but at some point I know I'm going to cave and I'm going to get the Lidl Plus card because I want that sour cherry conserve because it's quite nice, actually. And I like to have it on my crumpets. But yeah, thank you very much for watching this video. I know it kind of just fitted out, but yeah, let me know what you've been doing in regards to trying to save money with your shop, because obviously we've got a cost of living crisis still, probably. And we need to sort of all come together and give each other little tips and tricks of the trade. So yeah, thank you very much for watching, everybody. I'm gonna go to my car that's way down there. Yeah, it's definitely over there. I haven't just come up to a car park just to film these videos. It's down there. You'll see me driving up like that. So yeah, see you later, everybody. I'm going down here. Obviously I'm gonna come back because I need to get the camera, but you know, it looks good for you know, walking off. It looks good for the sake of the shot. I don't own this Mini Cooper over here. I actually own this Land Rover that's behind it. Nah, I'm just joshing you. Don't own either of them. Can't drive. Right. Click the little buttons up here. This one's about music. This one's about life. And there's probably two more. Fuck it. Let's put two more up. This one's about, I don't know, London, and this one's about, this is an album that I've just put out. See ya. Hey up, everybody. My name's Joshua Morrison, director of Johnny Mozzles, our lessons and conference, and today I want to talk a little bit about the cinema, right? So I'm not someone who actually goes to the cinema on a mega frequent basis, but whenever I do go, it's always a nice little time. Even if I'm seeing a movie that is complete, you know, garbage. I think the worst movie I've seen in the cinema is Grown Ups 2. It was really bad, as you can imagine. I mean, like, it's Adam Sandler at his worst. But you know what? I went and I actually had a good time. Even though the movie itself was terrible, I had a good time, right? And it's the same way I've gone to see good movies in the cinema. I saw Interstellar in the cinema. That was a good movie. I saw Independence Day, the original, in the cinema. That was really good. And all sorts of films that you see, right? And I think the being in that environment makes the film a little bit better, right? In most cases, particularly with blockbusters, particularly with things with big action scenes and, you know, big names and all that kind of stuff, the spectacle is kind of represented by the environment that you're in. And that helps to appreciate what's going on in the film a lot more. Comparatively, watching some, like, small indie sort of thing in a big cinema doesn't quite have the same impact on me compared to if I was to watch that, say, at home on the telly, because it's a smaller film, so I feel like it deserves a bit of a smaller environment to actually watch it. Now, if you're someone like that goes to the sort of Quentin Tarantino school of philosophy, or the Christopher Nolan school of philosophy around cinemas, you might quite disagree with that, because it's kind of streaming and all these various things are killing the cinema experience. And that certainly is true. Cinemas are failing all across the country. This one's just opened up. I'm not sure why. It'll probably be here for about 2 years and then it's going to disappear. I haven't actually been in yet. I'm not actually going in after the video. I'm just doing a video here and then I'm going to fuck off down that way. And basically, the reason that I sort of thought I'd come out here is look at the films that are here, right? So you got Moana 2. You've got Gladiator 2, you've got Paddington 3, you've got Red 1, and that's just the name of the film, and it's quite a lot, you know, that's a lot of sequels, and that's an issue that's always been around, is sequelizing, is the fact that people want something that's familiar to them, People want something that they can recognise. And you know what? I'm not going to fault people for that. I'm the same. The new Alan Partridge series is coming out next year. I'm excited for it, right? He could go out and he's made plenty of like serious, Steve Coogan has gone and made plenty of serious new original things, and I've just not bothered with them. But I keep up with the Alan Partridge because I like it, right? So we all do it, and let's not pretend like we're better than other sort of people who do just love seeing the new sequels or the new Marvel movies or whatever. Because we all have that. We all have our comfort viewing. We all have that thing that resonates with us. And that's fine. And I'm happy to have this kind of entertainment that I might not be into if it makes other people happy. Because that's the most important reason. That's why we make stuff, right? It's what, because we want to make some kind of creative expression that resonates with people. And sure, it might not resonate with me. I don't like the Marvel Cinematic Universe. I think it's a load of shite. But it clearly resonates to millions and millions and people who love it, and it helps them. I bet the MCU has stopped someone from offing themselves. I bet that kind of thing has happened. I bet it's, you know, brought people together. I'm sure relationships have formed over a brilliant experience seeing 4-2, which is like one of the worst ones, right? So all of these things kind of come together in this cinema, right? Well, not this one, but all sorts. And it's not just Big View, Cineworld, whatever the American ones are called, right? Those big chain cinemas that show the new blockbusters like these, right? Well, this isn't one of them, actually. This is a smaller India sort of one. And there's a few of those. Like, there's one in Barnes, I can't remember the name of it, that does loads of, like, random old films and stuff. I saw Full Metal Jacket there. I saw Rocky there. I saw a couple other films, I can't remember what. But you get the general point, right? Is you're seeing old stuff in the cinema, you're seeing kind of classics, etc., etc. And I think there's a lot of that kind of going on, and that can help bring people together as well. So if you're not into one thing, you've got another thing for you. And I think we should start going out into these collective experiences more and trying to get out of the house. Right? Because it's very, very, very easy to, you know, get lost in the Netflix streaming. You know, you end up going on episode one, and then before you know it, you're on episode fucking nine, right? And it's annoying because it's the cliffhangers. It's the cliffhangers at the end of each episode that get you. And then after the fifth cliffhanger, you're kind of just exhausted. You're like, fuck off with the cliffhangers. Just give me a resolution, for God's sake. This is why I don't really keep up with serious, like, serialized drama TV. Because it just goes on so long, and it's constantly blue-balling you until it gets to the end, right? That's how it feels anyway. But with a film, I like a film because it's a single collective experience. If you're in a cinema, you've got other people. And even though in the UK we don't clap and all that sort of stuff, it's nice to hear like the it's nice to hear like other people laugh in a comedy. Even if it's not particularly good comedy, you're there laughing with other people. People were laughing at the bloody Grown Ups 2 film. It wasn't a completely dead audience. And if I was to go back to that film, like there's the bit where he jumps off a cliff and his anus kind of spreads over another man's face, right? That's the kind of humor we're talking about. It's not particularly funny stuff, but with other people laughing, it kind of allows you to loosen up and to laugh. And I think that's what the magic of the cinema is. It's the other people being there. Like, sure, it's nice once in a while to be in a cinema and it's literally just you on your own. But imagine if that was every single time you went to the cinema. It'd be kind of dead. It's the same reason if I was a multi-millionaire, I wouldn't really want to make my own private cinema because it would just feel lonely, just sitting in this big auditorium all on my own while a thing plays at me. I just feel like that would be a little bit last act to Citizen Kane, you know? Wouldn't be too into that. So that's generally the overall point of this video, is just a few musings on cinemas in general, because they are dying. And I think what's going to replace the View cinema and the Cineworld and all these things, showing these big blockbusters, because I do think the blockbuster in general is dying. I think what's going to replace this is because we're going to have this need to communicate and to converge and convene in certain areas, right? For the sake of some purpose, right? What we're going to find is we're going to start seeing more small picture houses, independently owned sort of things, that instead of showing the new films, the new blockbusters, whatever, they'll show just whatever they think might resonate with people. Do they think Rocky might work? Yeah, go for it. Do you think the Rocky Horror Picture Show might work? Yeah, go for it. Do you think Rocky 2 might work? Yeah, go for it. So you'll slowly, over the course of probably the next 25, 30 years, you'll start seeing more and more small picture houses, maybe one screen, maybe like a rooftop car park sort of showing sort of thing, or maybe we'll just start putting projectors in the parks, you know, because projector technology is getting a lot better. I've gone to someone's house and they just had a projector, just like it was normal, right? And it looked bloody good as well. Like, he projected it onto his wall, like the entire wall, like the size of one of these windows, right? That was the size of his TV, and it looked good. The colors were crisp, right? So if you extrapolate that out to maybe a slightly larger group context of maybe 20, 30 people, you could definitely get 20, 30 Rocky Horror Picture Show fans to come down to one particular area with one person with a projector and make that happen. So I don't think the cinema experience will die. I think it will change and it will adapt the same way that it has throughout the ages, the same way that in 1895, people went to the cinema, which wasn't really a cinema, it was just a small auditorium, like quite a small one, and they showed the train film, you know, the thing where the train's coming towards the camera, and loads of people fled the scene because they thought the train was going to come hit them, right? So it's gone from that to seeing Avatar 2 in the Cineworld, right? So I think from there, I think that's bloated and hit its peak in terms of largeness. I think now we're on a trajectory downwards away from scale and large-scale kind of films, and more towards smaller independent works, and we're going to start seeing more community-driven cinemas and less chain-owned, corporate-sponsored sort of ones, which in a way is good, but I also do think that in general it means less money for pictures as a whole. So we're going to start seeing less high-budget productions, less $100 million budgets, more $1 million budgets. But I think with the advent of new technologies that make the democratization of film a lot easier, you know, like I can film this and it looks basically film-like. I know it's not the most interesting shot in the world. I don't pretend to be like some brilliant director of photography or anything, but it is a shot that could be in a film. It's shot on super 35 millimeter, so I don't see why it couldn't be in a film, right? And that costs 600 quid, that camera, right? And as time goes on, in 15 years, it'll probably cost 200. And everything will become easier to do from the individual point of view. You'll be able to make something like this. You already can make something like this if you so want to. Right? You can make a film like this. Look at like the Joel Haver projects. Some of them have actually been screened. Look at the Big Les Show with Tumor Island 3, where they screened that in a little tour. They did a little cinema tour of the UK. They also did one in Australia, I think one in America as well. But yeah, they did all that kind of stuff. And so I think we're going to start seeing more of that, more community-driven cinema experiences and film experiences, and less Paddington in Peru and Gladiator 2. So thank you very much for watching this video. I hope you managed to get something out of it. If you disagree with anything I said, please let me know. Vice versa, if you do agree, let me know. Yeah, that's basically the video. So have a good rest of the day. Take care, everybody. Bye. Hey up, everybody. My name's Joshua Morrison, director of Johnny Mozzers, Lessons in Confidence. And today I want to talk to you a little bit about getting down and just feeling a little bit down and how you can kind of try and get yourself out of a rut while still acknowledging your own emotions and that kind of thing. Because whatever it is that you're feeling right now, if you're not feeling too good, it's totally valid to not feel good. And it's totally fine to feel the way that you do, because there's a reason that you feel the way that you do. And it's just trying to figure out why you feel like this from a logistical and analytical point of view rather than from an emotional point of view. So let's say, for instance, that you've just lost your job, right? It's very easy to sort of sit down and just go, oh my God, I feel so awful. Like, I did this and then I did this and I just sort of feel like this and I feel like this and this kind of thing happens. And it can become very overwhelming because all of a sudden you're bouncing from thing to thing to thing to thing, and you're not really understanding how these things may relate to a larger answer, right? Well, what you kind of want to try and do is to try and figure out why this thing correlates to this thing. And once you can figure out those two points, then you can connect those to a third. And by that point, now you have something that you can fill in. And if you spend your time filling in this gap, then everything will start to make more sense. And the more sense it starts to make, maybe it won't immediately solve the bad feeling, but you at least know why you feel like this, and that can help you in the long run, right? So sometimes you just need to feel bad. Sometimes you just need to be sad. And that's completely fine, right? Even when you feel like maybe there's no reason to feel like this, and that in itself can be confusing. Sometimes you don't need to find the answer straight away. Sometimes you just need to wallow, and that's okay, as long as you don't do it too much and do it forever. Because there's a certain point when you need to stop with the emotional side of things, because you have done everything that there is to do within this emotional sphere. And now there's the logistical understanding sphere that you need to fill in. And once you can fill in that one, this one will start to empty as you start to fill this one up, because it's a balancing act. Because we have two sides of the brain. It's probably pop psychology or whatever, right? But you have two sides of the brain. You've got the logistical side and you've got the emotional side. And you want to give both of them your respect and your trust. There's no point shutting out your emotions in order to just feel the logistics. And there's no point not bothering with the logistics just so that you can feel your emotions, because that might make you feel like you're more true to yourself or whatever, right? You need to have a balance of both, because you're a complicated person. You're a way more complicated person than anyone gives you credit for, because we're all complex beings, because the human experience and the human life is very long, very arduous, and very intense, and very varied. There's so many different experiences that you'll have. And you might see someone who's like 60, and you know, maybe they're just working in like a branch of Waterstones or whatever. And you might feel like they're a bit of a boring person just because, like, just on the first instinct, right? And you're not judging them based on that, but you just see their life, you're like, that's kind of a boring life. And then you get to talk to them, maybe at the pub or whatever, and they tell you about like their mad endeavors around like the Sudan or whatever, you know? And then you find out that they were in like some like pop punk band in the late 2000s, or maybe you find out that they went on tour with the Rolling Stones or something like that. I don't know, but you understand the point that I'm getting at, right? Is that everyone has their own story, and everyone's story is way more complex and varied than anyone can give it credit for, even themselves. Because I bet that person that works in that branch of Waterstones feels the same way that you did when you first saw them and made that little judgment. They feel like their life is boring. They feel like they're not good enough. They feel like there's others out there that do better than them, that are more interesting than them, that have more to say than them. But we all have a lot to say. And it's not about, you know, do we have 98% of stuff to say, or do we have 99% of stuff to say, or 97% of stuff to say? It's about figuring out how to say it. And it's about it's about figuring out yourself within a wider context. And, you know, when you feel down, that can cloud your judgment, it can cloud your worldview, and it can cloud everything that's around you, because it literally will feel like there's a dark cloud over you. And it will feel sort of hard to get away from the rain that comes on you all the time, metaphorical rain. And you'll sort of sit there and you'll go, look, I am a decent person at the end of the day. I try to be a decent person. And yet it still feels like life is throwing this hard stuff at me. How do I deal with it? And there's no easy answer on how to deal with it, because what might work for one person might not work for another. Some people might get something out of like the self-improvement, like dopamine withdrawal thing. Other people might not. Some people might, you know, turn to religion and might get something out of religion. Other people might not. Some people might take up yoga and some people might think it's a load of shit, right? But whatever works for them, works for them. And I think as long as you try and maintain a positive outlook, which I know is very vague and very generic advice, but as long as you do it, then you will at least be on the path to success. Because it's not like, ooh, I've got a positive outlook now. Ooh, look at all the trees around me. Aren't they all so green and lovely? Oh, isn't everything so brilliant around here? Fucking freezing deep down, you know, because you'd be lying to yourself, right? But it's about trying to see the actual positives that are around you. Like right now, I think that I'm surrounded by beauty, even though the trees are dead, even though the sky is grey, even though this tree is a lump of old shit that just shouldn't really be here, you know. But it doesn't matter to me, because what I see is the nice things. I see that tree over there that you can't see, and I just think that's a gorgeous looking tree. You know, I don't sit at it and just sort of think, fucking hell, it's so grey and miserable around here. It's so fucking grim. Everything's so shit, you know, because it's very easy to feel like that, because it's very easy to feel like negativity is the more important thing to notice, because negative things are negative and you want to avoid those negative things, right? So you try and look out for them. And that's logical. That makes sense. And I understand why we do it. I do it sometimes as well. But What you want to do is try and notice the positives in the world around you. Try and find the things that make you feel happy, because the more that you start to notice them, you'll notice more of them around you, right? Because the more that you take this journey towards, not enlightenment, but just, I don't know, you know how enlightenment is like a light comes down? Maybe you've just got like a dim light and you kind of want to make it a bit brighter and brighter, and then you make the world around you feel brighter and brighter in the process. You just want to feel happy, right? You want to feel happy, but at the moment you don't. So you're trying to figure out how to solve that. And it's a very complicated issue. And sometimes you'll have setbacks that'll push you back. Sometimes you'll feel artificially super on top of the world because of some good event that comes to you, and you'll kind of sit and think to yourself, like, at some point I'm not gonna feel this good anymore, and how am I gonna deal with that? And then at some, you know what? Once that time comes, it won't be as bad as you feel like it will be, because it's very easy to catastrophize the badness, when at the end of the day, the badness is always a bit better than you think it is going to be once you get into the nitty gritty of it, right? And then once you're in the badness, now the only way you can go is up. The only place you can go in a sphere of darkness is into the light, right? And all you can do if you feel sad is try and understand your sadness, validate yourself for it, whilst at the same time not, you know, bringing down the world around you and trying to see the positives in the world around you. And while that can be very hard and it can feel like you actively have to try to do it, the more that you do it, the more it will feel innate to you. And the more that it feels innate to you, it won't feel like a task to accomplish, and it will start to just feel like an overarching worldview, and it will just become second nature to you. Because, and then you'll just start seeing everything as positive. Like, obviously, like, you don't see literally everything as positive. If a bad thing happens to you, like I stepped in a bog on the way to film this video and it fucking stinks. That's not a positive thing, right? But you shut out the negative things, you acknowledge them, but then you put them in a box marked negative stuff, and then you get on with your life, right? Because this little box of negativity right here, you can open it and look through your old memories and see where you were and see how far you've come. But then at a certain point, it's nice to just put the box down, you know, push it under the bed and just breathe in nice, positive energy that's around you. So thank you very much for watching this incredibly hippie-esque video. I hope you managed to get something out of it. I know I'm a little bit all over the place with how I'm trying to word my point, but I think you generally get the gist of what I'm saying, right? Is that you need to try and have a positive outlook in order to see positivity, and the more you see positivity, the more you will feel the positivity, because it will breathe into you the way the air comes in through the pores of your skin, right? So thank you very much for watching this video. Hope you got something out of it, and have a good one, and have a good day, a proper good day. And if you're having a bad day, just feel like, you know, I get why I feel like this. I totally understand it, because, you know, I have bad days as well. We all have fucking bad days. Even like Alan Watts had bad days.